Hi everyone, it's Michelle from Studio City Now, and today my guest is Nick Heratatos. I hope I pronounced that right.
Perfect.
And we have talked several times, and you were like so incredible. You've got this great book out called No Limits, a true story of challenge and courage across three continents. You started out in Greece, the son of a baker, which I found, you know, I bake, and I know a lot of love goes into baking. You built this little silver car, and I guess this was around the 40s, around World War II?
No, after the Second World War.
After Second World, okay.
I was born after the Second World War, and the car, I had an argument with the car in the late 50s, yes, late 50s.
Oh, okay.
Very young, very small, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it was a silver car, almost like a go-kart type thing.
Yes. But it was a four-seater. Two on the front, two at the back.
Oh, wow. A go-kart sedan.
Yes.
And Detroit didn't pick up on it? So anyway, tell us about your argument with the car.
Okay, first of all, I want to say hello, Michelle, and all your listeners. It is nice to be here, and thank you for having me.
Thank you so much.
As far as I can say about the car is when my dad left Greece to immigrate to what was called then Rhodesia, he didn't want to take the whole family. He wanted to go there first and see how things are and then to bring the whole family. And when he left, I decided I had a bicycle, but I fell down from the bicycle once I was speeding and I broke my ankle. My elbow mm-hmm. here. And I thought, because I love speed from the young age, very young age. I used to go up to the hills with a bike and come down. I like that air, that wind flying through my face. And then I decided, no, the bicycle is too dangerous. I may get myself killed or hit or injured in a big way. So I decided to build a small car. So it was easier than done. So took me a bit of time. I was thinking how to do it, talk a little bit, this and that. And I had a good engineering mind, even at a young age. But I knew by myself I couldn't do it because I was, at that time, I think like 10 years old. And so I went to my brother. I said, brother, can you help me to do this thing? He says, what? I said, listen, you're 5 years older. You have very good engineering thing like me. But I need somebody big older, you know, more mind. So he says, I think I can help you. I think let's do it, but I will only do it when I have time. So I got all the components that I need. I bought some, I made some, he helped me, he made some, he, you know, so as we started, he got committed big time. And it took us, I think about 18 months or something like that to actually have it. We put brakes on it. We put pedals on all four because you can't, one person cannot carry four. I mean, okay, they were all youngsters like me, but I couldn't really cycle them, all four of us. So I made it in such a way that we had pedals, all of us, all four seats, you can pedal. So we could go fast and we can do all that stuff. But then one day we were coming down on a hill and on a light hill and the steering wheel. No, let me go a little bit back and say that we knew we want to make it out of something light. So the chassis was out of aluminum. It was ahead at that time. So I thought, you know, how can we make it? And some ideas from this and from that. My dad wasn't there to give us an idea. So it was just me and my brother and asking, you know, some of my uncles, some friends, some, we had a steel maker very close to our home that we asked him how to do it. And he says, you know, I can tell you this and I can make you that and I can do this, but don't put metal because it's too heavy, da, 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 da. So anyway, we decided to go on aluminum. Even the wheels, they were a little bit of aluminum and it was the rubber tire outside, but the tire was solid. It wasn't with a tube, it was solid. So once we had it running, everybody wanted it. It was unusual. Nobody had seen that thing like this before. So all my friends, all my neighbor friends, they wanted every time after school to go for a ride. And of course, I was burning to go for a ride every day. So coming down on that little hill one day, and the steering wheel had a bolt with a nut. And somehow the nut and the screw itself came loose. And so much so that the whole steering wheel came out. So I thought, oh, well, that's fine. You know, we hit a fence, but it was just a fence. The fence went in, you know, the front of the car, it was still strong, nothing, you know, because it didn't have lights and things like that. It wasn't for the night, it was more for the day. So I thought, okay, now I don't have the screw. How can I do it? How can I go back home? So I went into a construction building. That they had all these planks, they were putting concrete, and I saw this big nail like this. It was almost like a pen, this size, just like this size.
Okay, that's the size of a big pen.
Yeah, a big pen. So, well, it was probably about this size, like that. And the steering wheel thickness was about this thing. So I had this extra. So I didn't realize anything. I was so eager to ride it. Just put the nail in. And we went home. The next day, the guys came. They said, let's go again. You know, so I said, okay. I didn't thought about getting anything. We went up to the hill this time, and we wanted to come down because it was really nice. But I didn't, I was reckless. But I think that actually helped me in my life a lot due to the fact that we start running down. And I said to everybody, listen, we're going to go fast here. So try to control the pedals and the brakes in the event we get out of speed. But I didn't realize, you know, at that age, when the car starts running, it ran and ran more and more and more and more. So our weight actually, and the weight of the car just push it down. So I knew I couldn't really take the corner. So I got out of the corner, and as I turned the wheels like that, we hit a ditch. And as we hit the ditch, the car flew up in the air. It flew up in the air and then landed, and we hit a sort of a little hill, so much so that it was like a brake, a very, very fast and very strong brake. So everyone, the two guys at the back, hit us. My cousin that was sitting on my right-hand side, he flew out of the car. And the guy from the back ended up in his seat. But because with my steering wheel, the guy behind me just climbed on top of me, and he pushed me against the steering wheel. So much so that the nail, it was rusty nail from the construction site down. Really rusted. At that time, what do you think about rust? Eh? So the nail went through my leg here, right there.
Oh my gosh, that's like mid-thigh inside.
Okay, it came in, it got in there from there, and it came out here. And then it went from there, and it came out here. Can you see this thing here?
Oh, it went through both legs?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
It hit my bone, and it bent, and it hit this one. Now, I didn't realize that when that thing happened. So I tried to get out of the car, but my leg was actually tight. Something was holding it. And the guy at the back says, Nick, wait, wait, wait. Because while I was doing this to pull I was actually tearing it up. So he put his two fingers, pushed the foot down, and he pulled it. The blood was flying everywhere. It was actually pieces of meat. It was horrible. The wheels open of the back of the car, the front wheels, because of the it opened up like this, so the car couldn't go anymore. And so anyway, I cut my shirt, I bandaged it to stop the blood because it went all inside my shoes. Everything was dropping. And everybody said, "What are we going to do?" I said, "Well, what are we going to do? We have to go." But I couldn't walk, so they took a hammer. We hammered the wheels. They hammered it because I couldn't do anything. I was licking my wood, so to speak. And so they hammered it a little bit, and the wheels came straight, and then they put me on the car, and we drove home. But I didn't say anything to my mother. I went straight into the bathroom, and I washed everything, and everything was still bleeding. I tied it down with the bandages, and my mom asked me, what are you doing in the bathroom? I said, Mom, I've fallen on a rock, so I have a small cut. And I didn't say it to her, because I knew if that happened, I wouldn't ride the bike again, the car again. She would have stopped it. So I think it went 3-4 days. The next day, I couldn't really go to school. So my cousin sort of helped me to go to school, helped me to come back. It was painful and it was getting worse and worse. And I think it was 3 or 4 days later, I was sitting at school in the class, and my pen was a round pencil falling down. And as I bent down to pick up the pen, and I put my head here, I smelled rotten, something rot.
Gangrene, yeah.
Yeah, it's a rot. So I, oh my gosh, what is going on? I thought, oh, this is something serious now. And so I went to my mother when I went back, and she looked at me and says, we have to go to hospital right now, because everything was yellow pus and all that stuff. So, and they had to keep me in, you know, they cut the pieces out. Oh, it was, yeah, so it was a good lesson. But because of that, while I was recuperating, and my mom banned me for 4 months, you will not touch that car again for 4 months.
Smart lady.
And, yeah, she says to me, how can we go to Rhodesia and you go with no legs? What can I tell your father? So I thought, okay, while I was there recuperating and waiting, I thought, you know what, I have to grow up now. I have to grow up. So from that day onward, I decided I have to grow up fast. And since then, I became a very, very responsible person. So that was a very big lesson to me in my life. Very responsible. So much so that a lot of people, when at the time I reached 14, 13, 14, 15, 16, they say, you know, you are so responsible. You are so, you know, you're thinking all these things so carefully. You don't talk easily very fast until you give it a thought. So that really, I think it made me change altogether my lifestyle. So that's my little story about the car.
Well, in Asia, there's an expression, out of something bad always comes something good.
Yeah.
Out of something good doesn't always come something good. So your bad experience was a learning experience, and it shaped a lot of, actually all of the way you think.
Yeah, I'm lucky actually not to lose my legs, because it was in the bone and everything. And they said, look, it's 50-50. We'll cut that stuff, we do it here, but you stay in hospital a few days, we'll see how to monitor. And then I went and recuperated at home, and they used to come and visit, you know, get all these different injections and all this type of anti-this and anti-that and anti-this and anti-that. And they were thinking, you know, the first 3, 4, 5 days, they said, well, we'll see how it goes. We'll see how it goes, you know, so... My mom was very scared, very, very scared, very scared. So I told her I was very sorry. It happened. I didn't thought properly. I should have bended that nail, because that nail was so rusted,
mm-hmm.
that I should at least take the pliers and turn it up. Instead, I was so eager to go and ride the car. Just put it there, get in, let's go. That has a price. That taught me, don't do that anymore in life. Be always prepared. Always prepare before you do anything. So that gave me a very good lesson.
And while reading your book, I saw that. So your family had to leave Greece because of the Germans? Or because of the economy? I mean...
No, my dad's brother, who they fought together, the Italian army in northern Greece or south of Albania, Mussolini forces, they fought them first, and then they fought the Germans. And him and his brother, they both fought the war. My dad was injured, recuperate, back to the war, the combat. Then there was a civil war in Greece for 5 years.
Oh, okay. That I did not know for some reason.
Between the conservatives and the communists. One was supported by the West, the other was supported by the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc. So his sister and brother disappeared, and you know, it was all that type of thing that happened. It all connected, interconnected, not connected, whatever. So he was very sad. He didn't want to stay there. So in late 50s, he decided to leave Greece and go to Rhodesia, what was called then a colony of Britain in Southern Africa. So, and everything was English, you know, learning the English mm-hmm. history, the queen, the da-da-da-da-da-da. Even, you know, everything was different because that was Africa. Africa was different to Europe. And even the road, when you drive, it was on the other side of the street, or the opposite side.
Mm-hmm.
You don't drive on the right hand side, you drive on the left-hand side. And the cars were not left-hand drive, they were right-hand drive, because it was English, you know, like Australia and so on and so forth.
Right. So in Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe.
Yes.
Okay, now I'm going from memory, because I did read, you learned two of the local languages.
Three, actually.
Oh my gosh. Three. But your father owned a bakery.
He started first a partnership, and then after a year,
mm-hmm.
a year or 18 months, I think it was, he decided to buy his own bakery. This bakery was not running to full capacity. But my dad was a master baker, very well person known. I mean, you know the whole stories about the Nazis. They how they took the commandeer the bakery to supply bread, and how they could have hanging, you know, and all that type of stuff in the book. Because, you know, that's how it started, because that's what it was so important to me in my life, to hear that and know that my father survived to be killed by them, to be hanged. In fact, they don't kill, they hang. They save bullets. So he started, he bought this bakery, and he actually owned it himself. Yes.
Okay. So, I mean, just so much going on. Okay. So he had the bakery. When did you take over, or did you buy your own bakery?
Well, actually, it goes a little bit back. Let me say something, because I think this has to go back. It will answer you all the questions at one time.
Okay.
So when I was 12 years old, we moved to Rhodesia. I was 12 years old. I can talk for myself. I was the last child in the family. We moved to what was then called Rhodesia, as I say, a British colony in Southern Africa. And at the age of 14, I started help a little bit part-time at my father's bakery.
Okay, now, yeah, that was it, yeah.
I did this while I was attending high school. I was not asked to go there by anyone. But every time I visited there, I saw a lot of activity there. Vans loading with bread, trucks delivering and offloading bags and bags of flour, sugar, oil, people in and out. It actually excited me so much. It excited me so much that I wanted to be part of that action. And that's where I fell in love with businesses. There and then, I decided to own my business, to own my own business as soon as possible, and not to work for anyone in my life. That was when I was 14 years old. So when I was 16, mm-hmm. I noticed that a business came up for sale, a restaurant selling food and groceries named Mambo Cafe. I was 16 years old at the time. So when I saw that, I thought to myself, why shouldn't I buy this business? I didn't say I want to buy this business. I asked myself, why shouldn't I buy this business? What can stop me? So I immediately started thinking about how I can buy and how I can get involved with it. So I had some money. I saved a little bit of money, and I felt it was a good business for what I saw. I thought if I can put a small down payment for the money that I have and pay the balance on installments, I should buy it. Why not? I should buy it. So I told my father, there is this business for sale that I want to buy. He looked at me and he said, are you sure you want to buy it, Nico? Because in Greek, Nick is Nico. You know, when you talk, they call Nico. So I say, yes, Dad. And he asked me again. He says, are you sure you want to buy it? I say, yes. You know, he opened his hands like this and says, yeah, okay. He says, then, son, if you like it, anything is possible. Go for it. I was so surprised. I thought, okay, if my father feels, he felt good that I can handle it. He checked first. He just asked me. I gave him the answer. When he looked at my eyes, he saw that I was serious. So he says, go for it. I felt good because I passed it. It was so easy, that hurdle. It was very easy. But because I was 16 at the time, I wasn't old enough to buy a business, get a license, put it in my name, or sign checks in the bank, because those days we didn't have credit card, and most of it was cash and checks. So I went to see my mother. So I asked her to I present my case, and I asked her if I could put the business in her name. I can put a contract, open a bank account, and have her sign the checks. So I even suggested that I will sign. I will take the checkbook to her, because those days they used to give double checkbooks. 100 or 200 checks, you know, with a hard cover, because we keep it for such a long time, the hard mm-hmm. cover, so it they last for a long time. So when I told her that, so I said, you sign the checks, you know, the checkbook, when the whole book, so I don't have to come and bother you again until the next checkbook, maybe after 3 months, 4 months, 6 months. So she was a little bit surprised, and she says to me, she looks at me and says, what, Nico? She says, how can you go to school, help part-time in the bakery, and manage that, you know, on the business. So I explained to her, I could do this because the business has 6 people already, and there is a manager in there running it. The owner, the present owner, has other businesses. So he comes, he brings the inventory, he collects the cash every day. The manager runs. I say, I will do the same. Why can't I do the same? You know, he does it, I'll just continue. I'm not going to fire the manager because I'm going to school. I help. It's so easy. You know, it was so easy to look after. And it's a good business choice for the money I had. And I wanted to improve the business overall. Anyway, after I spoke to her nicely, I convinced her to support me. And it was close to home and the bakery. It wasn't too far. And I told her I was prepared to work hard to make it happen. My mother agreed and gave me her blessing. So I bought the business. So that was 16 years old. It was very successful and gave me a lot of money. So much so that after 3 years, I bought another bigger business with 14 people, and 3 years, sorry, and 4 years after that. Sorry, I bought the first business. 3 years later, I bought the next one with 14 people. And then 4 years after that, I bought 50% of my father's bakery.
And how old were you, like 22?
That time I was, when I owned all the three companies, it was three, I was 25.
25?
25, yes.
Oh, so my goodness.
Yeah, wow. I owned all three businesses when I was 25. So I really liked it. I like businesses. And so to me, it was, how can I say, it was like a playing, like it was like a challenge. I just liked it. So I had the bakery for 4 years, 3-4 years. And then I decided to sell all. You want me to tell you the story, or you want to ask me and I'll answer you? If you want, I can tell you the story.
Tell me. I mean, I'm fascinated.
Okay. So
I mean, I like this. This is cool.
Okay. So after that, well, let me just start how to put it together. Okay. So after I ran the business for 3-4 years, my dad, he came to me and he says, you know, I have always been working in my life. I like to come back and try to get involved. He was not feeling happy being sort of retired or semi-retired. Mm-hmm. My mother came to us and worked with me up and said, you know, what about doing something with your dad? You know, make him, you know, to own the bakery altogether. I felt for the sake of my father, he did so much for us. He actually sacrificed so much from Greece and everything, start in a new country. So I said to myself, okay. But by that time, I changed the bakery to much bigger. I changed the business altogether. I bought machinery. I done the new, younger, more energetic way. I done streamlining. It was incredible. Just to give you an idea, by the time I sold back the bakery to my father, and I didn't make any money out of it, despite the bakery was almost double of the production, we produced at that time 11,000 loaves of bread a day.
Wait, 11,000?
Let me repeat again, 11,000 loaves of bread a day.
11,000.
11,000. Okay. Now, in addition to pastries and other baking products like meat pies, etc., we had two shifts, more than about 60 people. Okay. So that time, when I sold it back to my dad, it was producing 11,000 loaves of bread a day. We have 8 vans to deliver bread to more than about 80 or 90 supermarkets in different cities around our city. Then it was up to 70 miles radius, 70 to 80 miles radius. Okay, so I decided to do a little bit more crazier than what I was doing. So I sold all the three businesses and I decided to go more than 200 miles away in a bigger city. I had no friends, no relatives. I knew no one, nothing. And I decided to open a drive-in cinema. So to me, that was something new, completely new, but I liked it. I thought it was nice. But I took a risk because I put all my eggs in one basket. I sold all the three businesses and I was starting a business from scratch. The drive-in cinema actually was three businesses. And these businesses, they're interconnected because, let me tell you why. When we started doing completing the complex, I wanted to make sure that those businesses are not so much interconnected that if one fails, the other one goes down. It will take all the whole operation down. So I decided to do something new. I opened a very big restaurant, fast food restaurant, to produce up to 250 half chickens a night.
Half chickens?
A night, 250 half chickens a night, okay? And the bar, also opened the bar, the first in the country, which became a trend for others to follow in the future. We had music outside, the building, you saw the building on the photographs.
Right.
Even today, when you look at that building, it looks like a spaceship.
Mm-hmm.
That's 50 years ago. Huh? It was a long time ago.
Yeah, I'm looking for it right now in the book.
It's at the end. I can get you if you want. Let me get the book.
Okay. I think I have it.
By the way, you have seen the latest book now. Can you see the...
Yes, bestseller.
Number one bestseller. Can you see the flag there?
I see. Okay, the main building, Cornet Drive-In.
Yes.
Here it is. Oops, there it is.
Yes. So you can see that building, that is more than 50 years old.
We have factories that look like this.
Yes. You see. Okay, that was my design. I wanted it to be like that. So the restaurant and the bar was inside on the front. So I determined not to fail. So I thought, well, we did that on the plans, but we had more space. So I thought of building a children's playground.
Mm-hmm.
So we built a children's playground so families can come and come early, play, and then eat before the movies. We still have more land available after the playground. So I thought, okay, I planted 900 cypress trees around the property, 900, to make it really look beautiful, all green, cypress trees that they became. We bought them, they were 15 feet tall, but those ones, they can go up to 100, and they're always green. So after we created the playground, we had some more land available. So I decided to build a full-size soccer field so we could play soccer matches every week. Because, as you know, I was a professional soccer player. I still play soccer today. I still play soccer every week today. I've played so far now almost 3,000 games.
Oh, my goodness.
3,000 soccer games, okay? And of course, the drive-in had 800 parking bays, 800 cars. So we thought, there is a parking there. They can come and park, watch soccer, play soccer. They go to the bar to drink. They have food to eat. Then they watch movies.
And a playground for the kids.
And playground for the kids. And we had soccer games every week. So it was very successful. The operation was very successful. That after a year, I bought a commercial laundry and dry cleaning business. A year after, just a year. And then a year after that, gold mining operation. I invested quite a lot of money in a gold mining operation. So that is my story as far as that is concerned, as far as what I did by the time I was 20. Built the other one was 25. I built the drive-in cinema 25, when I was 25. In fact, people would come and say they want to speak to the manager, to the owner. And I say, I'm the owner. I say, no, we want to speak to the owner, not to the manager, to the owner. I say, no, I am the owner. Even when I was younger, for my stores in Gatuma, when I was living there, when I was 16, 17, 18, they said to me, no, you can't be the owner. You know, I said, if you want to deal with me, if you want me to buy stuff and things from you, you have to deal with me. I'm the owner. They couldn't believe it. So.
And you did all this by the time you're 25?
Yes.
Okay, so you've got the laundry, the gold mine, the cinema. Actually, some of our drive-in movies, because that's what they're called here, I remember when I was younger, they had the playground for the kids, but they didn't have, you know, like the bar or the soccer fields. Now our regular daytime movies, they have table service. They do have a playground. You know, they kind of work on that model. But I love that model because it's got everything.
Yes, yes. Yeah, we tried to make the whole thing as a family, because in the restaurant, we had not just food. We had everything that you wanted, every type of candy for the children, drinks. And the mother and father will go and drink in the bar, have something to drink there. The children will buy the food from there, they take to the car, or we had a lot of tables also outside. They could sit there, watch the movie on the screens, and the speakers, they were everywhere. So they could hear everything. And they had such a so many options. So they were not tied down. They had options to do anything. And the food was very nice. I had some really good cooks there that they produce fantastic bread, food. And it was all very luxurious. The place was all full of glass, tiles, beautiful chairs, everything really, really first class. First class. Too good for at the end. You know, when I think about it now, I think, man, I spoiled them. I spoiled them, you know, rotten, so to speak.
But they loved it.
Yes, yes. It was very successful.
So you eventually, did you sell the laundry and the cinema or?
No. Well, so let me just say to you, I had the drive-in for almost three years. And yeah, this is a big story I'm going to tell you. Are you ready for it? Okay, so.
I've got my coffee.
Okay, so everything, the gold mining operation was going very well. We had about 70 or 80 people and growing. Everything is in the book. It's the how it was done. The gold mining operation, the gold mine takes a lot of money, but also it produces a lot of money as well. The laundry was very, very, it was the biggest in the city. I made it the biggest in the city. We had a lot of depots that we, in shopping centers that people will come and drop the stuff there. And then we had drivers to collect them and bring them to the business. So everything was going very nicely, but unfortunately for us, entrepreneurs in Rhodesia, a harrowing guerrilla bush war started that was supported by China and North Korea on one side of the country, and the Soviet Union and its allies on the east of the Eastern Bloc on the other side. So there were two, China, North Korea, and the Soviet Union, and the Eastern Bloc. Yeah, China, North Korea, the Soviet Union, and the Eastern Bloc all supplied weapons and trained the guerrilla fighters to destabilize Rhodesia. So because I spoke three African languages, that's why I'm coming to this to you now, because I spoke three indigenous African languages at the time, and because I was a successful young businessman with management experience, I fitted perfectly for a new military units that were created by the government to protect the local population in the border areas where the fighting was taking place. So I was drafted to be trained and to become a military commander with 3 stars and with a knowledge of combat operations and hot pursuit tactics on the front lines of the Rhodesian border. My duty as a commander was to patrol the border areas for 4 or 5 hours a day with my soldiers and to be in charge of the newly built protected, they call them protected villages. Protected villages housing up to 5,000 people. My headquarters was in the middle of the village with 35-foot towers, observation towers, with machine guns and sandbags in all 4 directions. Men, my guards and soldiers 24/7 with radios because we had many attacks, especially in the night. We have to repulse those attacks. And we had enough ammunition to fight for many, many hours. Also, I was required to carry my machine gun on my shoulder for 18 hours a day with 100 rounds of ammunition. So I was always ready for combat. My sleeping time was 5 hours. And even while sleeping, I had to have my machine gun right next to my bed. So always ready for combat, even next to my bed. You know, it was, everything was ready for combat because the rockets, propelled missiles, and machine gun fire, they will come from every direction in the middle of the night. So you always have to be ready to repel them. So I did this for 2 years. And I saw a lot of my soldiers killed, some injured. And I wondered actually every day when I was in the jungle, what I was doing there, what I was doing in the jungle. I was a businessman, loving people. If I wanted to become a military guy, I would have joined the military when I was young. But I was a friendly person. I'm a businessman. I'm an entrepreneur. I like to talk to everyone, enemies and everything. It doesn't matter. And they knew this. And that's why they trained me, because they also used me for interrogations on the languages. And because I knew how to break them down in terms of talking nicely, make them laugh, make them cry, everything, it took me there. But when I was wondering what I'm doing there and things were not getting better, were getting, you know, getting worse, I was wondering what I'm doing there. And I'm actually lucky to be alive today. And I want to thank my lucky stars. So because of the war, that what started, it's all in the book. You know, the book, it's got more details. If I have to tell you, it will take one day, because we were a landlocked country, so they attacked us from everywhere. We could handle it, but I was just not prepared to put my life, because I had two options. Because of the war, we could not sell the business. No one wanted to buy under those particular circumstances. So I had two options: continue to fight and to fight the war and maybe get killed or maimed or injured in the process, or leave the country and move to South Africa. So after, well, South Africa at the time was the most industrialized and one of the richest countries on the world, and in fact, the richest on the African continent.
Right. This had to be what, the 60s?
Late 60s.
Late 60s.
Yeah, sorry, sorry. Well, South Africa was rich from 60s onwards. Yeah, but I to me, it was middle to beginning of the late 60s, 70s. Yes.
70s. Okay.
So South Africa at the time, let me repeat again, it was one of the richest countries on the planet and the richest and the most industrialized country on the African continent. So me and my late wife, Anne, decided after 14 years of hard work in Rhodesia to leave everything behind and urgently leave the country before my next deployment to start again from the beginning, from scratch in South Africa. And we did just that. That's what we did.
Yeah, because I saw you move to Durban.
Correct, yes. You want me to tell you a little bit the story about Durban?
Tell me a little about Durban.
Okay, so we decided to move to Durban because that's where Anne, my late wife, graduated university. And it was a coastal city it was very vibrant city, quite big. It's the third biggest city in South Africa at the time. And in South Africa, I created my beautiful family. I went to flying college to complete training and become a successful pilot. I flew with my own airplanes all over Southern Africa for business and pleasure. I continued playing professional soccer for my city of Durban, just like I played in Gatuma and Fort Victoria in Rhodesia. There, I created, bought and built 11 successful companies there. Some of them I made 3 to 10 times bigger. I will mention 3 if you want me to. But all the others are in my book and explaining how it was done.
Right. And the book is called No Limits. Yeah. And everything Nick touches turns to gold. Just amazing. So okay, let's go into just 3 and then we'll how you wound up in San Diego.
Yes. So we moved to the city of Durban, where the city of Durban has the biggest port on the African continent. Hundreds and hundreds of ships coming in and out every month. In fact, story about my cousin, I actually had 3 cousins, but one were very close. He used to come to Durban to visit me quite often with his ship. He had a big tanker, 200,000 tons, colossus, very big. So, and then I had another one, a freight, big freight ship with different hatches. And that one was like 60,000 tons. But the oil tanker was big, like three soccer fields, more than half a mile long. It was incredible. Anyway, so we didn't have so much money at the time when we moved in because we left everything behind. We didn't sell. We just left the driving behind, gave it to a friend at a very low rent, 1/10. The dry cleaners and laundry, we put a fire price. It was like 5% of what I bought it, what it cost me. I just wanted to get out because I had only 4 weeks to get out. 4 weeks, I had to do all that. Houses, everything and everything. And so we did whatever we could to get out. We decided that was that we got. So I started, when I moved to South Africa, we didn't have so much money to buy a business and buy a house. But I wanted to buy a house for the family because by that time we're expecting our first daughter. And I decided to open a security business, to start a security business from scratch. So I did this because it doesn't need a lot of capital. Security business doesn't need a lot of capital. You don't need machinery. You don't need equipment. You just need a little bit of equipment and the outfits and people. So because I was fresh from the military experience at that time, and I knew I can train and create the best guards and security officers in behavior, skills, and appearances. So the uniform that I decided to put in, it was navy blue long trousers with light blue, a little bit lighter blue than this, tops.
Okay, almost like a sky blue.
Shirts, yes, like sky blue. The boots were, and black belt, black leather belt. And the boots were black leather, long military boots. They look a little bit like Air Force, Navy type of thing. You know, I wanted that. I didn't want it the sort of the greenish color and all that type of stuff. Because it was right in the city, and we also targeted certain markets. The ships, the harbor was so big. I think the harbor fits 120 ships, 130 ships. And I'm talking now ocean ships, not boats. I'm talking big, big, big ships, okay? The biggest port in Africa. So, because there were a lot of money there, we also targeted big motor dealerships, big ones, like Mazda, Toyota, and all these big Mercedes-Benz, BMWs, and all that stuff. Very big apartment buildings and commercial buildings, office buildings, etc. So I started it. I trained the guards, everything, and a friend was doing the same. We broke even within the first 6 months. At the end of 6 months, we broke even from the profit to losses, broke even. And within 3 years, we had 300 guards. 300 guards, okay? We had about 10 vans with the security officers, inspectors, that they will go. We had, you know, all the control rooms and everything. We grew bigger and bigger. And then we started banking. We started banking as well. So that business grew and grew. So in less than a year also, after arriving in Durban, I bought a house, a beautiful house, which the photo is there. It's in the book that my wife wanted. She loved it and wanted to keep her happy. She deserved it. She was a fantastic person. She was always next to me. And they say for every successful man, there is a successful wife behind, successful woman. Some people don't understand that. I believe that because it happened to me a lot. So I didn't have the money to buy the house, to put a deposit, and then the new person in the country. Mm-hmm. But I used all my negotiating skills with the seller to buy that beautiful home, and we bought it. And it's in the book how I did. It's a special chapter that how I negotiated with the seller to buy.
Yeah, it's I'm not going to look for the chapter, but I do remember reading it.
Yes. So business number two was actually a leather business that I bought a year later. Because as you know, I got ends in my pants, you know, as my mother used to say, you have ends in your pants. So to me, one business wasn't enough. I wanted to run 2, 3, 4 companies at the same time. Because I created a system, I created a model to have managers to run it, and I'm basically obviously on the top. I don't answer telephones and things like this, but I teach them, I train them what I want from them, and I let them run the operation. I'm in the background. When they need me, I'm there. But they were the bosses. They were the bosses. I like that. I wanted them to be the bosses. They felt like the bosses. They were earning good money, but they were making also good money for me. That was my motto. I want them to get good money. I want them to live well because I gave them incentives. And if they reach those incentives, they get good money. But because those incentives are also based on my income as well, we're both making money. I'm very happy about it. That was my motto in life. I've done this over and over and over in 23 companies, 23, and it worked. And I have the model. The model is there. I can discuss with everyone who has, you know, the fire to make them. Anyway, so I bought a second business. This was a making exclusive leather garments. Exclusive, really, really, very nice. Very nice garments. And they were supplying to specialized, over 400 specialized boutiques in South Africa. 400. So at that time, it had 18 employees. But I could visualize this business, what I can do, because it wasn't run properly. And most of the businesses that I buy businesses that they don't run well. They used to call me Mr. Fix It because I can fix business. I can fix any business. And if I see that, the way I see is I look at the business, this particular one to say, and I say to myself, okay, they got 18 people now, but what can I do with this business? How it's going to be that? I visualize how it's going to look down 5 years down the line, 10 years down the line. So I liked it and I thought, okay, I'll buy it. So I started, I bought the business and I immediately start moving it to the new factory, new brand new factory. I installed new machinery and equipment, use all my business experience and I expanded this company from 18 employees to about 80, 80, and increase sales and profits about seven times.
Wow.
Seven times. We also exported high quality leather and suede garments to the European market. To the European market, all the way from South Africa.
That's amazing.
Now, I'll tell you the company number three, which is one of my favorite ones, because it was so easy and it was so nice. I really enjoy, to me, it was like playing games, you know, playing. That's how I see my business. It's playing. It's enjoyment. I love going to work in the morning and I love going back home at night. I love both. And of course, I love flying and I love soccer. Okay. So about four years later, another business came up for sale that I bought was a battery chargers manufacturing company.
Right.
For battery chargers. Because you have buses, you have trucks, you have yachts, you have cars, motorcycles, motorbikes, motorhomes. You have all these things that they have batteries. They need batteries, okay? And in Africa, a lot of places don't have electricity. So to have TV and radios and refrigerations and everything, they use batteries. So there were little shops that they actually had battery chargers to charge batteries and people bring it in to take it home. The whole of South Africa, especially in the rural areas, up to the mountains and things like that. Okay, so when I look at this business, it was in a terrible condition, in a bad part of town, dirty, very unpleasant environment. It was old counters, equipment, everything. It was like a junkyard. So again, I looked at it and I thought about it. I could visualize how this business is going to look 5 to 10 years down the line. And I thought, man, this is, the products were good, except that they didn't have enough knowledge here how to produce in mass production, expand, and go for world markets. After negotiating with the seller, I bought a company and moved it into a new factory complex that I just built. And I installed modern, mechanized, and streamlined facilities. Because to me, I streamline things. I want things to run smooth. I sit and I make a plan in my head, and then I make notes, and I make how the flow must go.
Right, I remember the battery charging, because didn't you move to another factory, or?
Yes, we also went to a bigger factory again. So
and cleaned it all up.
Yes, throw things out and clean up the good things, you know. Anyway, so I went to overseas also to see different shows, and I increased the range, 25 different models. For different purposes, for motorcycles, for cars, for this, for that, specialized welding machines, you know, all these type of things. Also, we went overseas to more than 40 countries I visited in shows that we present our products, but also see what those countries produce, price, competition, quality, the modern, the way they look, modern or conservative, whatever, coloring, all that stuff, because it was very similar to the fashion business.
Right.
Because fashion business, you change it every 6 months. You got new models every 6 months, new designs. So to me, that was a challenging. This business was basically like a toy playing, really. Mm-hmm. It was like playing with my hands, you know? So I turned this company into the biggest manufacturing battery company, battery chargers manufacturing company, and welding machines and related products, because we made some medical equipment too.
Oh, okay. I don't think you got
into
that.
I did not say that, but we did. At that time, they had the AIDS, how to destroy needles, because those days, you remember, some nurses, by mistake, they prick their fingers and they catch AIDS.
Right.
Well, we produce a machine that actually destroys the needles.
I do remember that. Yes.
Decelerate needles. Yes, you know, next to the, when they give the injection, they don't put it in the box. They have this machine. You just throw it inside there, and the machine automatically incinerates it. So there's no anything left behind. Anyway, I turned this into the biggest company manufacturing those products in South Africa. And in fact, the biggest on the African continent. Furthermore, we exported to more than 30 countries around the globe. 30 countries around the globe. So I'm very proud of what I did with this company.
You know, I think my memory's a little fuzzy because it's been years since I've been in nursing school. I think we may have used that technology to destroy needles when I was in school.
Yeah. Because we supply around the world, Australia, Singapore, Japan, Greece, Italy, England, Portugal, Brazil, you name it, Egypt, Israel, India, all countries in the African continent, all over, New Zealand, ported all these things everywhere because we're always one step ahead. I had this research and development department completely just producing. I gave them, I said, come on, I'm always on pushing them. I want more, but produce the best quality. To me, it wasn't just quantity. Quantity to me doesn't mean anything. It is quality. The name, all my businesses, the name is unbelievable. The service and the quality and the price. It's all related, all related. That is why it was so successful. I will talk this to the right people with business entrepreneurs. I will talk to them. I think I can talk that language. But there is a lot of secrecy how you can do these things happen. And you can make it happen. But you have to have the determination, the passion, the desire to really never be stopped. And that was me. I would go every day to my research and development department. I want to see what you're doing. What are you doing? How can we do it better? How can we do it quicker, stronger, better quality, but produce faster?
Yeah, which brings me to the next thing. You learned to fly. You know, flying is addicting. I know this.
You know my story, how it started. When I got into the super constellation back when we're going to Africa, when the pilot called me in then, I saw all these instruments. I felt I was in heaven. I felt I was in heaven. But then and then I thought, you know, I have to fly. I have to fly, and even in the while I was in the military, we flew with helicopters quite a few times in combat and all that stuff. And but I knew I want to get my pilot's license, get the instrument rated, get all the things that you need to and fly good airplanes. And I flew some beautiful airplanes, very fast. In fact, I broke a South African record flying from northwest Namibia, just south of Angola, all the way to Durban. It was very, very, and I made a lot of good friends, captains, pilots, commanders, because our planes, we used to hire them to different companies, and we used to select our own pilots who we knew. And I was actually doing that, and I knew all these people, but we had very top, good quality aeroplanes, the best. Nixtar, you know, leather seats, and even perfume inside, there was a certain perfume. Maintained by the companies that we bought them from. They all keep them under the hangars. When we want to fly them, they pull the things out of the hangars, everything ready. We just go and check the planes, make sure everything was okay, go all around. You know, some guys talking about aeroplanes, they just go in, get in and fly, not Nick. I will spend at least 20 to 30 minutes go around the plane to see, to make sure.
You do your pre-check.
And then when my people come, because I always flew with 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 people, because it was cheaper to fly, taking all of them, and take sometimes over goods, you know, like the leather business. I would go from one city to another. I would take 100 leather jackets, 150, put them at the bed, take two guys, three guys, you know, the promoters, the agents, the brokers, all that stuff. And to me, it was just enjoying flying, you know. But I will go first into the airport in the morning, check the airplane was out, check everything. And then when I flew, I knew I did my homework with the flight planning, you know, the weather, check all these things and all these things. I was very, very precise and very careful how to do things. As I say, from starting from that age when I was 10, 12 with the car, I was very, very, very responsible person. And a lot of people love my flying. They said, man, how do you learn? You know, I have learned how to fly and learn properly. not boom. Somehow I had that feeling. Doesn't matter if you pull the engine, the engine's power off, I could still land the plane so nicely. To me, it was an enjoyment. I enjoy it. I love it. So yeah, any opportunity, fly. And of course, those days, because it was for business, the business paid for everything. Business paid for everything because it was for the business.
So from Durban, you wound up in SoCal, in San Diego.
Yes.
So I know Durban had some political issues.
Well, yeah. Okay, let's leave it at that. Yes. Okay. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So you want me to tell you that?
Yes, and then we're going to go on to the
California
coastal thing.
Okay. So I left South Africa for a couple of reasons. I had everything I wanted there. Actually, when I moved my four businesses under one roof, when I built a big complex, and one of the best looking complex in Durban, it was fantastic for me. It was like I felt on top of the world, really, because it's so difficult to get four companies under one roof. It's very difficult. Yes. But I was dreaming about that for 10 years. And the right time came, the beautiful property, beautiful park, and I built it. It was nice and have really beautiful companies to bring in. So I designed with that in mind. My building, my office actually was in the middle of the complex. I could see from different angles the businesses. And had also cameras when they're loading, offloading. It was actually, you come into my office, it was like a spaceship. And you know the whole story about the white carpet and all that stuff that I wrote there. But that I'm not saying now. So let me just say this. When I got all the four companies together, I fell on top of the world. I could just walk from one factory to another every day. It was right next to each other. And it was actually, I could see the work in progress of all the four companies together, four businesses. They were separate, but I would walk from one to another, to another, to another. It was actually incredible. So, but unfortunately, later the situation in South Africa changed quickly and the business climate declined. So life became dangerous and unpredictable. So, for the sake of my family, I decided, here we go again. Here we go again. I decided to leave South Africa after giving very, very big thought, said, and things like that. And for the sake of my family and for the safety. So I decided to move to the United States because my family's safety is always paramount important. But I vowed not to find myself in a similar situation when I had to leave provisionally. I was not prepared to do that. So here is what I did. When I say Rhodesia, by that time it was named Zimbabwe. And when I saw what happened to Zimbabwe, I knew it will also happen to South Africa in the future. I will say no more. I don't say any more politics. But I will say I saw what they were doing there, right there and then, under the new name Zimbabwe. So I knew it will also happen to South Africa in the future. And I wasn't prepared to be. So back in 1984, I visited the United States for the first time with my family to look for future opportunities because I had sense what was coming to South Africa. Remember, I spoke five languages on the African continent.
Right.
On top of English and Greek. So seven languages. So I could, you know, when you know different languages, you basically know the culture, you know the understanding, you know the mentality. But let me just stop there, okay? So I came to see here because I sent what was going to happen to South Africa. So we visited many, many cities, searching for the best city where to make our new home. Once we visited San Diego, we decided this is our new home because it looked and felt similar to Denver, very similar. And we continue visiting San Diego every year since then, since we decided to move to San Diego, until we moved here in 1996. So I bought my first business here in the United States back in 1993, while I was still in South Africa. It was a lighting company specializing in selling and installing energy efficient lights in commercial and government buildings. The company had 16 employees. They operated from six or seven garages, six or seven garages in Pacific Beach. But again, I knew what I could do with that business. I could visualize what I can do because I saw how they run the company. It's not difficult. When you're being around the business so much, you smell this, you smell it. It's like a doctor. They see you sort of not. That's my job. I was a doctor of business. So I could see what we can do with that business. So we had to move that. I had to move this company three times because of spaces. It was smaller, getting bigger, getting bigger. Eventually, I said, no, we're not going to do that. We bought our own premises. Again, I did similar to what I did in South Africa. I didn't write everything in the book, but I tell you now. I got one big factory and put a tenant in, and we got the other big factory for us. That was four times bigger than the first that we moved in. But if we had to move more, I would go, we'd take the next one. We wouldn't move. We just cut the wall, put a couple of doors, and it was right there. That's how it was, okay? Under my ownership, as I say, the company moved to three times, and we bought our own property. Now, when I sold this business, I had 120 employees. 120 employees.
And it started with what, six?
No, they had 16.
16.
When I bought it, they had 16. And we created 220. So at the same time, when I owned this company, I got involved in residential and commercial real estate, purchasing, and then also purchasing several shopping centers, commercial office buildings. And I also purchased another company involved with housewares rentals. Now, this company had hundreds and hundreds of apartments that we supplied housewares for, you know, glasses, plates, cup saucers, sheets, blankets, everything. Hundreds and hundreds in San Diego, Orange County, and Los Angeles. We had two trucks from San Diego going to LA every day, one to Orange County, and we had three here in San Diego. So this, after my three children graduated from school, from the university, they wanted to come and join the business. I never asked them to come. They said, Dad, we want to come, we want to learn, we want to be with you. It was fantastic because they all came, all the three of them, eventually, one by one. We used to go for lunch together. We used to have, you know, and my late wife used to come down. We used to have lunch together. And we had some employees working also. We leave the office with them. We go for lunch down in La Jolla Shores. Our offices were down in La Jolla Shores. You may know if you've been here for a long time, La Jolla Shores. And right on the beach. You always feel like you are in the water. Shorts and slop sometimes and all that stuff. If I didn't have to meet anyone, I walked down from my office, from my house. It was like 3.5 miles, 4 miles. Took me 40 minutes, 45 minutes to walk. But I always used to come down because it was up in the hill, come down. I didn't want to go up. I didn't want to take my body up. I wanted my body to take me down. So I left them. Eventually, my son took over and says, Dad, while we're operating our own businesses, we want to run the company, but you and mom have some break now. Go. I felt comfortable after I trained them, taught them, that me and her, my late wife, I grabbed that opportunity to do all the traveling that we wanted to do with that wife then. So that's where we did all the walks in different countries on our planet, not just California, but I did a lot of others. I didn't write everything because then I have to write, you know, another chapter, another book, including the California Coastal Trail, which, as you know, is 1,200 miles long, more than 2,000 kilometers. And it's from the Mexican-US border to the California-Oregon border. So we did that.
So I'm going to wrap it up with you telling me about the California Trail, and when we'll do another episode and we can go more into that.
Whatever you want, I'm available.
Okay, I was amazed because I know it's 1,200 miles. I actually remember reading about it. And you started the San Diego San Ysidro.
Yes.
But it took you, what, 16 years?
Yes, but we did it differently because we wanted to enjoy, to make our wives feel happy. And I took the initiative because, first of all, I was a commander. I know how to follow trails. I know how to do trekking.
Mm-hmm.
That was my job. I'm talking today because I was trained to do that. because of that, I'm still alive. And I had, we were about six or seven of us that we came with the idea, but not all of them did it. You know, some they did bits and pieces. I'm the only one that I started and finished the California Coastal Trail. And we did it with our wives because we wanted to have them. And I'm a city boy. I didn't want to, wherever I went, I never sleep on the ground. And right. I never carry stuff. I don't like to carry stuff on my back. I don't want to. I want to enjoy, you know, we the way we did it is we do, in 8 days, we do 7 days, 8 days, we do about between 80 and 100 miles, which is half, it's like a half a marathon a day. Depends the terrain, if it's up and down, whatever, whatever, if it's easy, if it's so. But we also had a good time on the way. The ladies, the wives, wanted to be happy. And we wanted to make them happy. And I was one of the first guys, and my late wife, and she actually said to her friends and said, tell us what exactly, what can we do? What can we tell them? What can we tell them to do for us? We want to go dancing? Okay. We want to do canoeing. We want to visit the museums. We want to visit this. We want to do that. We want to do this. And we did. Wherever we had the opportunity, we go cross rivers, big rivers, like Russian River. You must have heard about Russian River, which is north of LA, a little bit higher up by Bodega Bay.
That's quite north.
San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
So north of San Francisco. And then you have all these big rivers in the north of California. Klamath River, Smith River, you have some incredible, Eel River. These are humongous. Some of them are half a mile wide. We couldn't really cross them. We had to take boats to take us around, over. So they wanted to canoe there. They wanted to do this. They wanted to do that. We, 3-4 hours a day, we fit it in. So that makes them very happy. So it was like a beautiful holiday, so to speak. We'll have to sit and have tea. And on the way, we have, you know, we'll visit lighthouses, military bases, you name it. It's all there. It's a different type of holiday. Incredible.
Yeah, but the one thing when I was reading this, it was they didn't just walk, or you didn't just walk. You visited things and you enjoyed seeing things, and
yes,
stayed in hotels.
Oh yes, hotels, and also we had to have full breakfast every morning.
Oh yeah,
because first of all, we didn't want to look for restaurants in the morning. We rather go to places where they make good food in the morning, hot breakfast, and we want to have that for at least 4 to 5 hours in the morning, from 8 o'clock to about 11, 12, to keep us in a good shape. And sometimes we had a problem in the sense when we stayed in a small town. There was one in north of Santa Cruz. The hotel looked like you were in Texas, you know, a cowboy style bed back in the 1800s, 1810. So some of the guys say, hey, you know, we're not going to this hotel. It's fantastic. You know, they had the baths looking the olden days. It's like, well, come on, you know, let's go to this place. But they didn't make breakfast. But there were restaurants a block away. So we say, you know what? That's fine. Let the ladies enjoy, you know, with the balcony outside, the red color, all wood. You know, it was fantastic. So we would go there just to spoil them because they felt good. And you know, we had to do something for them to keep them happy. They were always there, happy, smiling. And, you know, to me, that's what I wanted. You know, when people take that stuff and they tell you at the end of the day, oh, it's so nice, you know, we enjoy this, and they look at you, you know, and they say, wow. You brought us safe, because there are some challenges on the way. Believe me, it's not so easy. Crossing rivers, and I had everything. First aid, ropes, you name it, flashlights and everything. And sometimes you have to use certain things. But I was always very careful not to put them in a danger. If there was something that I wasn't happy, say no. I had a couple of crazy guys, which I wrote a few of the things, few of the chapters. And we had some things. I said, don't do that because, you know, you can kill yourself too. And I don't want to be part of it. I don't want to connect my this adventure with anybody get injured. And I put my foot down. You know, you
well,
do it this
yeah.
way, or otherwise you go on your own. I don't want to be around. I take responsibility. You know, so.
Well, your friend Ron, who is no longer with us.
Yes.
From what I remember. Was he stubborn or what?
I think, let me say this. He was a captain, Marine captain. So he
enough
stayed in,
said.
So he was in Vietnam. So that just, you know, that straight away what that means right now. So he says, you know, I have learned in the Marines to go straight. We don't go this way. If there's a fence, we climb the fence. If it's a wall, we climb the wall. If it's a hill, we go straight up. I said, Ron, but you can't go like that, Ron. You got ladies here. You got your lady here. You got, oh, he says, they can go around. I want to go straight. No, no, no. But he was a very nice person. He was a bit, you know, adventurous, very adventurous, because he still thought he was a teenager. So, yeah. And some of the guys says, man, we don't want to put our lives under Ron. Says, no, 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 Nick, please take over. Please, we're not, you know, we cannot do it. But he always keep us very happy and very smiling. The jokes, unbelievable. He was such a nice person. We loved him because he motivated all of us. You know, he knew so much about California because he was born here. He grew up in San Jose area.
And oh, okay. Right below San Francisco.
Yes, he went to university in Stanford and Berkeley. Very intelligent person, very nice person, very nice. What a good friend. Now, I miss him so much. Even today, I miss him. After a few years now, he passed away. He was such a nice fellow. I always wanted to see him every Sunday to tell us jokes and tell us this. He was an attorney. You know, he was a civil engineer to start with. Then he became an attorney for real estate. And says, you know, I'm an attorney, but I hate all the attorneys. I hate all of them. I said, how can you say that? He says, because I don't like them. It was such a, I mean, I can tell you some political jokes. It's unbelievable. He keeps us, I mean, I met him back actually in 93 because he also flew airplanes. So we connected straight away from 93, you know, before I even immigrated here. So it's actually funny. Back from 1993. Very nice fellow.
Amazing.
He was a star. What a love. And his sister worked with us. His lady was with us. You know, he was a very nice fellow. Yeah. But a bit crazy, yes, crazy.
We're going to have to do a chapter 2, episode 2, because there's so much more I just want to get deeper into. But your book, No Limits, which is a bestseller again, how can we find it?
Let me tell you a couple of things there. All right, so my book is already a bestseller. And now I'm working on it to make it become a double bestseller, an international bestseller. I also want to make a blockbuster movie. That is my final desire.
This would be so cool. Yeah.
I know that my life has been unique, full of adventures, and I'm very thankful for it. To be honest, and I'm not, you read the book and you know what I'm talking about. Everyone who read my book loved it. And many told me that they cry at the end. And I have given quite a lot of speeches. Every week I give speeches. I gave one big speech in Las Vegas 2 weeks ago to about 300 people. And all these people now are calling me because they were from different parts of the US. They want me to start talking to them and everything else. So I'm open to visit and speak to people, but I will do that as long as there is, as I told the other day, more than 100 people, because I feel I can do so much for the younger generation. I want to inspire and motivate the young people to be the architects of their own destiny, to own their own business, be free, and be independent. And anything is possible. You know, that is my desire. So I want to make that, and I want to make a blockbuster movie. So if whoever is listening, out any of your listeners, and they have contacts in the movie industry, or they have friends or friend, serious contact, you know, serious people in the movie industry, they can contact us. My email address is nolimitsbynick@gmail.com. nolimitsbynick@gmail.com. And the book can be purchased on Amazon. So they can purchase it on Amazon. And also, I'd like to leave you with this. No Limits by Nick.
@gmail.com.
Yes, and Nick is N-I-C-K, not N-I-C or N-I-K. N-I-N-I-K, N-I-C-K. And I want to leave you this and for your listeners to know, there are no limits. I've done it so many times. There are no limits. It's all up here, what you want to do, and you must do and enjoy it. Enjoy doing it. That is how I see things. That's how I did things. And anything is possible.
After reading this, you know, because I think periodically I kept emailing you saying, oh my gosh, I knew somebody with the same name. And oh my gosh, you just moved from here. And I kept you updated on where I was. And just amazing seeing the things you have done in your life. It's like, it's inspiring.
This is what I want to teach the young generation of today, because some of our new generation here in the States, they expect a lot of things from somebody else. It's not so easy, and you're not going to get anywhere when you have that mentality. You have to take your own life by the horns, make waves, and also don't accept no for answers. And as you know, I wrote 15 pillars that they are intertwined. Sorry, 15 pillars of business and life success. And these pillars are intertwined with the 27 chapters. It is important that some of these people read the chapters and the pillars, and they can see how I intertwined them. It took me a long time.
Yeah.
You may not know, I wrote the book 4 times and it took me 4.5 years. And the book actually, it's dedicated to my late wife because it's for her memory. So many people, thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands can learn out of my experience. What I went through in life, how it came up every time, they can do it. They can do it if they prepare to really sit and do it and make it happen. And I'm happy to help a lot of people by talking to them. And after I speak, I can always spend half an hour answering questions, or I can meet them and talk. Like in Las Vegas, I spent quite a bit of time. People came to me. I'm having this issue, that issue, this. I said, look, here is my thing. You can do this, you can do this. But if you want more, I'm happy to connect with you on the telephone and everything and everything. And I'm happy to help anyone who is prepared to really make things happen.
That's great. And thank you so much. Like I said, we will do in chapter 2. And also, when I read about Anne having mesothelioma, I mean, I just lost it. I started crying. I'm like, oh my God, what a wonderful person. This isn't fair.
It's not fair.
No. But she was, you know, I wish I had gotten to know her. I wish I had met you then, because she sounds so inspirational.
Yes. Yes. And intelligent, loving, and also she was very helpful to humanity.
Right.
Very helpful. She liked to help people. And her mom was the same. Her mother was the same. But we can talk about that another time.
We can do that another time. Well, thank you again.
Welcome.
You have a wonderful rest of the week.
Thank you. And it was my pleasure, and the pleasure is mine. Thank you so much.
Mine too. And we'll talk soon.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.